Welcome to Make the Game. My name is Matt Hackett, and this is my podcast. We're talking about two main topics today. I think the one that probably got you here is the mention of money. Who doesn't love hearing about money? I might call this something like the money episode. Another big topic that I want to talk about is why UI is a critical game dev skill. I've been thinking about this a lot. For those of you that are new, you probably know me best from my silly little comics on Twitter. I like the Game Dev Cheat Sheet. You may have heard of my book, How to Make a Video Game All by Yourself, which you can pick up right now on Amazon.com. What else have I done? I made a bunch of games and whatnot. You can go look at my Steam games, A Wizard's Lizard, and Indie Game Sim, which I'm going to be talking about during this UI section. So let's jump right into it. I want to say real quick too, this is going to be kind of a sloppy, messy episode. I have one note card. I jotted down some notes. A lot of times, like in my previous episode, if you've heard my my 2 years indie postmortem episode, I was reading my article. Basically, I try to make it feel loose and real-ish, but I'm reading a script, and this time I'm not reading a script. So expect some more slop this time around. I got some energy I'm hoping to bring into the show. So, okay, we're going to talk about user interface, and then we're going to talk about money. Give me the money.
You're listening to Make the Game with Matt Hackett.
I've got a lot of thoughts about user interface, man. It's to me, it's like the least fun part of game dev, and I guess I kind of dread it, I suppose. And I might just be saying this coming off of I had spent a lot of time working on my game Witchmore, which was built in Unity, which you can go wishlist on Steam. That project is very much up in the air right now. I found working in Unity's user interface system absolutely dreadful. They do things kind of two different ways. I make 2D games, and so the way that you render like a sprite in their normal 2D setup is much different than the way that you render, say, like anything you'd want to have in a HUD or a heads-up display. Say, like, in the corner you've got a menu button or like a health bar or something. Those things are configured. They're so annoyingly different. Like, I'll have a base resolution I'll use, like the sprites in Witchmore are 256 by 256 pixels. And, I know what that's going to look like in the game when I zoom in. But when I put that into the image, it's not a sprite component, it's like an image or a raw image component, whichever is being used in Unity, the size is all different and weird, and the events are different. It's not a transform anymore, it's a direct transform. I don't like it. I don't like having to learn how to do things a couple different ways. That's just my thoughts with Unity. With my current game, Pixel Washer, it is a homegrown JavaScript ECS, or Entity Component System, and I kind of love how my user interface works. But, to each their own. I think the larger point, though, is that user interface is mandatory. I've tried to, weasel my way out of working on it too much. So, with Witchmore, even, I had this kind of game design pillar, where I was trying to minimize user interface as much as possible. So that's why, you pick stuff up in the game, and you can move it around, you can drop it, and to me, I was like, look, you've got an inventory slot. It's your hands, like in Spelunky. I had an earlier prototype of Witchmore, where you could hit a button and it would bring up, a very typical kind of grid-based inventory page, kind of like you'd see in a classic, Western RPG, or even the original Legend of Zelda, right? You hit the pause and whoop, the screen comes up and you've got your little grid of items that you can navigate. I had that in an earlier version, and that was exactly the kind of thing I was hoping to avoid as much as possible in Witchmore. No dialogue, no big menu screens. When Zelda games, going to pick on them a little bit, when you hit pause, there's always you can hit the left and right triggers to navigate around these massive menus. And that stuff just makes my eyes glaze over. I'm super passionate about games, but it's always I'm passionate about characters and environments and music and atmosphere. And most of my games have footstep sounds in them. I like that kind of stuff. But I'm kind of coming around. I'm starting to realize that to be a great game dev, at least solo or on a tiny, you know, indie team, you need to tackle user interface. You need to kind of enjoy it. And for me, it's like, I need to take my medicine. And there's a lot of reasons for that. I think that the like some of the best games out there have amazing user interface, you know? And every single time that I see a game that is extremely well received on Steam, I would lay down money that it has amazing user interface, that it has configurable keyboards and mice and game pads, and it supports all the things you want. It probably has lots of different resolution settings. It probably supports full screen. It might support dual monitors. I don't know, but it does all of that advanced stuff. That's how, it's one of the many ways the Steam games get to that coveted, overwhelmingly positive status. Please let me know if you know of a game that has garbage user interface and also overwhelmingly positive on Steam. Like, I will be able to learn something, but I'm convinced that an amazing video game has amazing user interface, and there's really no way around it. You, as a developer, have to accept that and tackle that, accept that challenge of user interface. So, on that note, I want to talk about my current project, Pixel Washer, which, if you don't know, is a chill, relaxing game about washing pixels. Well, the voice just comes out so easily for me. This is a game I have a really easy time talking about. I can tell you anything that you want to know about the game, because it's so simple. You control a cute little piggy. It's a classic 2D overhead game. It's retro style, super pixelated. There's really not much to it. You pick a level, you walk around, and you gotta clean stuff. You shoot your little power washing gun, you blast away the dirty pixels, and it's like, oh, ding, 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 you did it. Couldn't really be much simpler. You can run, you can oink, and you can wash. That's about it. Honestly, the rest is all user interface. And it doesn't seem like it would be, but it is. And because of that reason, you know, I basically got 90% of the gameplay done in the first, like, stinking 2 weeks of game development. You know what I mean? So I've had this wall, this huge wall of user interface work in front of me for months now. I just checked my logs. I've been working on and off on Pixel Washer for about 6 months now, and never full time. There's maybe a week here and there, but I don't even think I've had a week where I've worked on it full time. So I'm really happy with my progress and my speed on the project. But I think I kind of stalled out a little bit when I hit this giant wall of UI, and the current one that I've been climbing is basically configuration of the inputs. And this doesn't seem like a huge thing. Like, the game from the very beginning had mouse and keyboard controls, and then later I added gamepad, which I kind of regretted how I had implemented the keyboard and mouse, because it kind of made the gamepad implementation a little more difficult, but it all ended up being fine. The thing is, you know, I think this is true. If you're just making a game jam game, just a game for friends or something, then it's cool. You don't need anything outside of probably just put like a how to play page in your game or even on your itch page. I've seen that a lot, right? Where you don't even, like, the user interface in your game is so bare that your itch page will just be like, you know, hit space to accept, you know, walk around with the WASD keys or whatever. I think that's totally acceptable in the realm of indie games and especially games on itch. And, like, this is something I talk about in my book, How to Make a Video Game All by Yourself. I think one of the ways in which my book kind of shows some cracks is that I try to cover everything for everybody, right? I try to cover hobbyists, where I'm like, if you just want to upload your game to some servers and tell a friend, that's fine. But it also tries to kind of cover, you know, enough to get you across the finish line, even if what you want to make is, like, a very professional, world-class Steam game, right? So everyone's mileage will vary, and, you know, every project is subjective, but to me, Pixel Washer is a serious project. I do have my eyes set on Steam, and I firmly believe that if you're taking a game to Steam, the Steam players are assuming that you have at least checked the bare minimum boxes. And so that means, like, yeah, you should have gamepad support. If it's a game, you know, if it's a platformer or something, your players are going to expect that. And if they want to change the button for you to jump or for you to run, they're going to expect that. Are they wrong to expect that? I don't think so. I think that that is the assumption. I think too that there's lots of stuff for like they're going to assume you have achievement support. And maybe not everything. Like, I don't know if you have to support badges. I've never made a Steam game. This will be my third one with Pixel Washer. I've never made a Steam game that supports mods, and I think that's more and more becoming the norm, and that's fine. Maybe I'll get to that someday. So I had been kind of putting off working on the configurable input because I've done it before. I've done it many times. It's surprisingly difficult. I think because it's one of these things that needs to touch lots of different systems. And I'll kind of walk through some of what made that difficult for me. So first off, you need a list of all of your inputs, right? Which even with a game as simple as Pixel Washer, when you enumerate them out like that, it is a lot because right off the bat, you've got WASD, right? And you've got your arrow keys. That is the expectation. That is the bare minimum for how users expect to walk around in an overhead action game like I'm making. Now, the arrow keys, the way I've implemented it, those are kind of hard-coded. It is in the input data, and technically, I could add the code to where you could convert that to something else if you want, but I didn't do it that way. I implemented it so that you can change the WASD keys because, you know, you got to keep in mind, my game is localized into like 9 languages right now, and I hope I'll be able to hit that mark, but I want to be able to make it localizable for everybody. And so not everybody has WASD keys or wants to use WASD keys. And so those are configurable. So right off the bat, there's 4 inputs. And then there's a button for oink. There's a button for wash. There's a button for accept. There's a button for cancel, like in menu items. There's a button for pause. There's a button for radar. You press R and it goes whoop and it brings up this little menu in the bottom right that kind of shows a cute little icon for your piggy, and it shows some little red dots for where the grime is that you still need to clean before you can complete the level. Then there's also, I'm just calling this option, I'm probably going to change this, I don't like this, but I have a separate input that you have to press specifically for when there's a menu that pops up that's like, the level's over, press option to continue. But you press that button and that brings up another menu, and that menu is again like, oh, here's how you did it. You know, it took you 10 minutes or whatever to watch this level. Press option again to exit the level, you know, successfully. What is that? That's like a dozen inputs, right? And this is a simple game. This isn't one that has, run. There's another one. You have to hold a button to run. But this game doesn't have crouch. It doesn't have aim. It doesn't have bombs. It doesn't have ropes. It doesn't have scope. It doesn't. Here's another one I forgot. You can rotate your nozzle. So your nozzle has, it used to just be circular and there was nothing to rotate and you would just kind of aim at stuff and wash it. Now there's it starts off as like, I think it's vertical. It's kind of like an oval. And if you hit a button, I don't remember what it is, it's configurable now, so it's whatever you want it to be. You hit that configurable, I call it the gun cycle feature. You hit that and it goes whoop, and it rotates your oval from, you know, horizontal to vertical. There's another one. And so the problem there is that even with this really, really super simple game with barely any inputs, I've already got a solid page full of configurable keyboard inputs. And at a certain point, you have to start, like, that list might need to be scrollable. And my game has scrollable text, but that's it. It doesn't have scrollable other stuff. And so I would need to probably refactor significantly. I don't think I would even make it scrollable. I think it'd be too difficult in my particular code base. I think if I ran out of room for the keys, I would have to break it into a different menu. That's how I'd do it. That's probably how I'd do it, yeah. But that's a lot. And then you have to think about things like, I was hoping to kind of do things in line. Like, let's say you go boop, 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 and you select down to select, let's say, I want to change what the radar button is, right? And you select that. And in games before, I've implemented it to where it'll say, like, you know, change radar button, colon, it's R right now. And you hit the button to select it, and it would, like, the part that says R would change to brackets where it's like, press any button. And I couldn't really do that with my code base. Also, I don't like to do things that way anymore. Whenever possible, I like to do things split up into multiple entities. I like to spread the complexity, right? And so I call it an input changer. And when you select a input to change, it goes boop, and it pops up this pop-up, and it says input. And then it says what the input is, and it says press any button or key to select a new one. The complication there is, what if you want to cancel that pop-up? So for other pop-ups, you might hit like escape or backspace, but in this context, you have now assigned escape or backspace to radar or gun cycle or whatever menu that you've chosen to pop up, right? So edge cases to me are really one of the hardest parts of game development, especially when they overlap with lots of different other systems or components in your game. And that's exactly what configurable input is all about. Gamepad is a complicated one. It is mandatory to me to have analog dead zones, because gamepads just throw garbage at your game. I have two gamepads I'm testing with. One is an Xbox, an official Microsoft one, and the other is a generic, it looks like a Super Nintendo control, like a modern one, sort of. I forget what the brand is. It's pretty popular. I showed it to somebody else, and they're like, oh, yeah, you know, it's big on Amazon or something. But it's closer to a Sony gamepad, and that one sends, it's like got different data. It starts off by just sending some noisy crap to your game, right? Like, it never drops below like 0.1. When you look at the analog controls, it's usually represented as a normal, right? So if you're not touching your analogs, it would be 0. And if you move your analog all the way out to the outside, it'd be a 1, right? And somewhere in the middle, it'd be like a 0.5, right? You get it. And so some gamepads will just kind of like, they just send out noisy crap to you. And so to me, you have got to have, like, if I open up Pixel Washer on Steam Deck, Pixel is just always firing his washing gun, and he's moving down to the bottom right. Like, they don't have any ability to hold still, and it feels bad. And so the default analog dead zones needs to be, for my game, like something like a 0.3, or else you're going to get that really horrible feeling when you first open up the game. It's just unacceptable. Each of these inputs, keyboard and gamepad, they need to have a reset to defaults. And that's something that you've got to keep your data around. You can't just overwrite your data and be like, oh, you know, the key for oink used to be X, and now I don't know what it is or where it came from. Like, you have to persist that data of, like, I know what it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be X. The user can change it to whatever they want, but for now, it's X. Here's a complication is, you have these pop-ups sometimes. Like, when you beat a game in Pixel Washer, a little pop-up appears. It's like, all done, you did great. And then it says, you know, press X to continue, or press, or I think I have it as the option button, or backspace or whatever for keyboard. And so a couple things here, that's contextual. And I've got it set up, and this is not easy, but when you switch between keyboard and gamepad, the UI updates. And there's a lot going on there. You need to have an event or something that fires when the input switches from, say, keyboard to gamepad or vice versa. You need to have your event listener. So in my case, I call it the complete notification. That thing needs to be aware of when that happens. It needs to have access to its elements. So for example, the string that says press, you know, enter to continue. That needs to change. And the surrounding user interface, like the Chrome that I call it, that wraps around the menu, that wraps around that text, that needs to resize itself, because you might have changed that to, you know, it used to say press continue to enter. Now it says press left trigger to enter, which is a lot more characters. And if that's translated to, say, I don't know, Spanish or something, a lot of times, on average, this, here's a little tip for you. A lot of languages from English to especially other Latin-based languages expands the text about 30%. This is not always true. And for Asian languages, a lot of times the text is way smaller because they use compressed glyphs and stuff that get more, you get more bang for your buck out of the characters, right? But say, you know, left trigger might be in like Spanish, for example, it might be more like trigger of left. You know what I mean? I don't know Spanish. Escardo de trigger, right? I don't know what this, but it's more text. And if you have a hard-coded Chrome size like I used to have, then your text is going to explode out of that. Guess what? That looks bad. And that might seem like some advanced game dev stuff, and it is, and it touches lots of different parts of your game, but that's also the user expectation. I'm not exaggerating when I say that I've seen negative reviews where people are like, I was using the keyboard and it kept telling me gamepad inputs, right? And say you're playing like an action game or something, you walk up to a character and you want to like interact with that character, and it's like a little pop-up thing appears above that character's head, and it's like, press A to interact, and you're like, I'm on the keyboard, like A is left to me, like what button am I supposed to press? And sometimes that button is like, oh, it's backspace or it's left slash or something. It's not even Z, you know, it's not even always intuitive. And so that's why those pop-ups are there. And when they're not contextual for the type of input you're using, players know that and they don't like it and it looks bad. So that stuff is all really difficult. And in my context, it took me a solid 3 days of pretty much working all day, kind of on and off, to get the keyboard menu in there, to get the input changer pop-up to appear, to add all that stuff to the gamepad menu. Mouse, to me, was the last one I did, and it took the most refactoring, because the first pass of mouse that I did, I just had a method called like is button down. And I'm cursing myself yesterday. I'm like, oh, great. Yeah, is button. Which button, Matt? I got 3 buttons on my mouse here. So I've been looking at this wall for months, this giant, just like a whole page. I usually have a to-do markdown file in my project. And so literally a solid page of configurable keyboard and all the stuff that entails, configurable gamepad, configurable mouse. And I would stare at that list and I would just not work in the game for a while. I think it's good if you're able to kind of hop around between to-do tasks within your game. Like maybe you could go make some levels, maybe you could optimize some stuff, maybe you could add some polish. That's what I've been doing to procrastinate, because I didn't want to tackle the configurable stuff. But finally, I got to the point where I'm like, okay, this needs to be done, because the stuff that's next is all finishing stuff, and I was excited to get to that. So now that I've kind of climbed that mountain, I'm feeling really good. But I wanted to talk about, you know, getting over that mountain. I talk a lot about content mountain. In my book, I've got this drawing of you climbing a mountain, and you're so far up and the mountain is spiky and has all these cliffs and there are birds flying by you. You're so high up, but you can't even see the top because the clouds obscure your view. And that's what it feels like. That's where it feels like I'm at now. That's where it feels like I was at before I tackled the configurable inputs. And that's probably where I'm going to feel like I'm at when I get over the next hurdle as well, you know? So I think for me, what helps to kind of get over that hurdle and keep pushing forward, even if you can't even see the finish line, is to keep your bookends in sight whenever possible. I can see the finish line for Pixel Washer, you know what I mean? I know what all it's going to take to get it done, and I'm excited to get there. And there's also like a beginning, right? There's a title screen. You can save your game, like it saves preferences and stuff. There's things to get you started. There's a middle, and then there's an ending. And then like between there is just this gulf of stuff that's still left to do. But I can still give the game to you right now. You can go play it on itch. Pretty soon you'll be able to play it on Steam. And yes, there's an ocean of work left to do, but still there's a lot here. And getting this stuff to the finish line is what motivates me to do whatever is in front of my face. And I'm trying to concentrate on just the must tasks, as I call them. There's like could, should, must, and that's one way that I like to organize tasks, and I'm trying to focus on just the musts. So the more I think about it, a game that has really good user interface is one that's like more likely to be successful, and a game developer who is really good at user interface is more likely to be a successful game developer. On my previous podcast, Steam Marketing Gold with Chris Zukowski, he talks about this kind of moderate success strategy where, what did he say? You release 3 games in your first year. And I made a joke in that how that's impossible. And it's impossible to me. I still kind of feel that way. I know some people do it, and I think I know how they do it. And I may have even have done it before. I'll tell you the secrets. We'll get into that. He talks about sticking to genres, right? So if you stay in the same genre, you can reuse more code, right? And this is critical. If you follow lots of other indies like I do, you may have bumped into Spiderweb Software, run by Jeff Vogel. Their whole thing is they've been around for, I want to say 20 years, but I'm sure by now it's more like 40, right? It's how, in my head, Mario Sunshine came out 10 years ago, but it's actually like 100 years ago or something. But Spiderweb Software's whole thing is they make classic Western style RPGs. And when they make a new game, they use the same code base. And let's say you're a big company like EA. EA has a game engine in-house. They don't open this up to the public, but it's called Frostbite. And I guarantee you Frostbite has configurable gamepads. You know what I mean? Whenever Bethesda makes a new game, they're not worrying about configurable gamepads. They have that sorted out. And like, you know, there's no way they start from scratch when like they don't go get in it in an empty folder like I often do. Like I literally did with the game I'm working on with Pixel Washer. Well, I guess it's not completely true. I have been using, it's like a prototype engine, but the point being that it's like not a completed game. Like I was using a code base that was like, yay, that's code. It can render graphics. It knows what a mouse is. And it's like, does it have gamepad? Well, no. Okay. Does it have, you know, is it tapped into Steam's achievement API? Oh, no, no. Like, it was just this repository I've got on my hard drive that I use for prototyping, and definitely not like a full featured game engine. Right. And so I think this is the real crux. So this is a topic I've been wanting to talk about for a long time, and I thought I would get to it sometime in the last 2 years. And what I really want to do is make like a YouTube video just about this topic, and maybe I'll get to someday. But this is all I've got time for anymore. When we get to the money part, we'll talk more about this. But I'm at that point where I'm out of time, and I've just got to talk about the things now, or I'm never going to talk about them. So here it is. This is. This is really important to me. This is something I think about a lot, and I think that this is the critical thing to having a successful indie game career, especially for solo developers. This is a concept that I call a shell. And when I say shell, I mean like a shell that a crab would wear, right? Like a hermit crab. A hermit crab that like hops between shells, and it's got this little home it lives in, right? That's what I'm talking about when I say shell. I'll give you an example of a shell that I've used before, and I'll tell you how it has benefited me in my games. Back in 19, some years ago, my company Lost Decade Games, run with Jeff Blair, we were kickstarting a game called Crypt Run. Crypt Run. It was a it's a wizard's lizard. Okay, it's an overhead action game. It plays. People compare it to Binding of Isaac. Crypt Run was. It predated a Wizard's Lizard. In fact, we launched the Kickstarter as Crypt Run, and somehow people still supported us, thankfully. Later, we realized that we had an uninteresting main character and a really kind of a dull, forgettable title, and so we pivoted to a Wizard's Lizard. I think that was the right choice. But from here forward, I'm going to call Crypt Run, okay? That's the name of the shell, okay? So a Wizard's Lizard already benefited from this shell. In fact, it is the thing that created this shell. And so the shell is, in this context, it's an HTML5 JavaScript fully encapsulated game engine. And I talk about this a little bit in my book, How to Make a Video Game All by Yourself, out now on Amazon, $14.99. That a game engine is kind of loosely defined in the industry. And I think that I still feel this is true because Unity calls itself a game engine. Okay, and maybe that's true, but it is not a shell, all right? A shell is a completed game. A shell does everything that you want it to do. So, Jeff Blair and I, and our buddy Joshua Morris, who would do our music, we did a couple of game jams post Crypt Run, and this might have been after a Wizard's Lizard was out on Steam as well. But what we did, we didn't even consider for a minute writing anything from scratch. We weren't looking around at different platforms. We weren't even, Unity was you know, really picking up in popularity around this time, and we were still a year or two out from looking into that seriously. And so we had a shell, and it was our default choice. I think this is important. The CryptRun shell did everything. It had configurable keyboard, it had gamepad support, it had configurable gamepad, it had music and sounds and scenes. It could pause the music, it could pause the game, it could transition, it had overlays, it felt professional, everything was polished. Not only that, but we knew how to use it really well. So I forget which was first, but we made two game jams. I'm guessing this over the span of a year, because we contributed to the same Game Jam twice. I want to say it was Indie Speedrun, which I think doesn't exist anymore. Last time I Googled it, it didn't exist. But I'll put links to the games if I can find them. We made two games. One was called Asylum Knight, which was kind of like a Plants vs. Zombies game if instead of a homeowner with plants, you were a crazy person in an insane asylum. Sorry if that's insensitive. The other one was called Retreat to the Jeep, where you were an excavator unearthing fossils and collecting dinosaur bones and stuff, and you needed to outrun an oncoming lava river, right? Like there was a nearby volcano erupting. So two pretty different games, both in the exact same art style, both with the exact same shell. Not a game engine, a shell. And so what we did was we took Crypt Run, which was a wizard's lizard, right? We took this Crypt Run shell, we scooped out the guts, we took out Raga, we took out the wizard, we took out most of the enemies. And here's an important element too. We didn't take out everything. Lots of the crap that was in there for Crypt Run just stayed in there because it wasn't hurting anything. And you know how it is. Like sometimes you want to be like, hey, can I remove this sword? But that's a load-bearing sword. So don't remove that sword or your whole game is going to come crumbling down. So we would just change what we needed to change. And we would make our game that way. Change the title screen, add new music, make a brand new game. But the important thing is you've got this shell. And importantly, this is the way I was able to make Indie Game Sim in 6 months. This was in 2016. Lost Decade Games went out of business. Jeff went and got a job, leaving Matt, me, all by myself with a computer. And I had a 6 month runway. I'm talking to my wife. I'm like, okay, I don't want to go get a job yet. I want to keep this train going. Like, this is the train I want to stay on. How long do I have before I got to go get a job? She said 6 months. And I said, all right, I got 6 months to make a game. That seemed reasonable to me. I'm pretty pleased with what I was able to do with Indie Game Sim. And what's pretty sobering to me is that Pixel Washer has kind of just hit that point where it's almost feature compatible with that old Crypt Run shell that I used for Indie Game Sim. But it hasn't yet, and not even. It doesn't have Steam achievements and stuff. And it's certainly not as robust. Like, it hasn't been launched on Steam and gone through iterations where players give us feedback and we find some bugs and we fix them and all that. So after 6 months of working on Pixel Washer, granted, this is part-time on Pixel Washer, but I still do not have as robust and feature complete as a shell as I did with Crypt Run and Indie Game Sim. So I wanted to make Indie Game Sim. I took a Wizard's Lizard codebase, which was the Crypt Run shell, as I'm talking about, scooped out the guts, redid everything so the resolution could be lower resolution and pixel perfect, you know, add a new font. Also, it became a side-scrolling platformer slash simulator, right? Whereas a Wizard's Lizard was an overhead action game. So different genre, but using the same shell. And there's no way in the world that I would have shipped Indie Game Sim in 6 months. Any other way. Unity, no, absolutely not. It would have taken me 6 months to be like, all right, I think I can make a game now. I'm not exaggerating. That's what it was like with Witchmore. Love 2D, I've experimented with that in the past and I was able to get up and running with it quickly. I was so easy to learn Lua because it's so similar to JavaScript. It's easy to use, but no, it would have taken 2 or 3 months in the Love 2D platform for me to get back to that point where it was as complete of a shell as the Crypt Run code base. And I think that this is a skill to stick to a code base because I want to use Love 2D. I do. I want to make a playdate game. I want to start from scratch. I kind of want to get back into Witchmore and plug around with Unity. I so badly want to try Godot. I've farted around with it a little bit, and this is like 6 months ago, a year ago. It was really fun. I installed the C# plugin because I know C# really well, and I didn't want to learn GDScript yet. I want to reinstall Godot today. I want to start a new project on it today. I want to. That's what I want to do. That's what I would do if I were rich and I could do whatever I wanted, right? I can't afford to do that. I cannot do that. I have to use shells moving forward, right? So I guess that's my rant about shells and user interface. And I think the overall point is that stuff like user interface, UI, right? Menus, all the complication around keyboards and gamepads and configuration, all that stuff is hard. And all of that is a solved ass problem if you are using a shell that you have shipped a game with before. And I think this is one of the reasons that people talk a lot about, like, you need to crank out games. You need to make those 3 games a year. You need to not spend too much time on your first game or whatever. Crank it out, get your first game out there, and then find the strength to do what I usually can't do, which is hold your nose and use that old, ugly code, right? Because, you know, I'm making an HTML5 JavaScript game with Pixel Washer. There's a world where I went back and used the indie game sim code base, which is the Crypt Run shell. There's a world where I had the strength to go and do that, and Pixel Washer is done by now because I didn't have to spend the last 3 days redoing configurable keyboards and gamepads and stuff, right? The problem is that, like, indie game sim is a super old code base. Oh, I can't even want to think about it. 2016? Oh, 8 years. It's 8 years old at this point. It's super crusty. The documentation is ancient. And, like, if you can do that, like, that is a power. That is a skill. If you are capable of doing it, that's one of the reasons that Spiderweb is still in business. Seriously. Is because they're able to do that. And I can't always do that. But moving forward, I don't see another path for me without using shells. So, like, my goal is to finish Pixel Washer, finish it strong, get it on Steam, fix all the bugs that come up, get everything working, like Steam achievements and all of that. Once the game has stabilized, that's it. That's my engine. I'm using the Pixel Washer shell for everything moving forward. And if the only way I can switch engines is if I have that funded, right? If I want to go spend a month or two learning Godot, that needs to be paid for, or I don't get to do that. My next game's must be built upon the Pixel Washer shell, right? Because otherwise, why would I spend all that extra time redoing stuff like configurable gamepads and keyboards and menus and everything? It doesn't make sense, and I'm gonna drown if I try to keep doing things that way. Okay, so that's my shell rant. I hope that makes sense. I know that's a new term. You might have your own term. That's what I call a shell. I think most people just call it a game engine, and that's fine. But to me, a game engine is something very different. A game engine is like, oh, you can make a game with this. And a shell is like, this is a game that does absolutely everything you can do. It's you are a hermit crab, and you can just whoop, just pop into that shell, and you're good to go. Okay, so finally, we're getting to the money part. I did promise it. I know that's probably why you're here. Everybody clicks on the word money. If you see my podcast in a big list, you're going to be like, these episodes all sound boring. What money? Ooh, money, money, money. The money episode. Let's get to it. If you've listened to my last episode, it was my 2 years indie post-mortem. And I have used up my runway. I had a 2-year runway. My runway is gone. I saved up that money. I have a wife who also has a career and stuff like that, but I am not a wealthy person. I do get paid well when my engineering chops are put to use. I came off of a stint for just shy of 5 years working at a mobile game company and socking away money where I could, and then you know, I pushed myself hard and I got super burnt out, and I did that as long as I could. And then I took a break, and I am just a weirdo who's got to get back to my indie roots. So that's what I did. And just a quick tangent, I guess. It took me a while to realize this, but like the burnout, man. I mean, I talked in my 2 years postmortem. I had some health issues as well, but like, and maybe this was related, but the burnout took me a long time to recover. That first year might have all been like mostly set up and recovering and resting and relaxing and planning, you know, because in retrospect, I don't even really feel like I had a solid 2 years. I feel like I had 1 year. And if I look at it that way, I'm actually pretty pleased with what I was able to get done. Oh, it's not bad for a year. If I think about it as 2 years, I feel like I barely got anything done. So that's where my money has come from, is from working as an engineer for many years and socking away money. And, you know, I live in an expensive place. I live in California in the United States. So it would be smarter of me to, I could move back home to the Midwest where literally my first mortgage was $200 a month, if you can believe that, when I was in my 20s. I do have, and this has been a goal of mine since Lost Decade Games started back in like 2011. So for over a decade, I have wanted a source of passive revenue while we're talking about money. And I have that now with my book, How to Make a Video Game All by Yourself. And here's a fun thing. That book has made about $35,000. Sounds good, right? That sounds pretty good. Here's an interesting factoid. That is more than my first ever programmer's salary. Back when I was in my 20s and I was working in the Midwest at just like a small little web company writing PHP. And that sounds pretty good. And I'll tell you this, for a first time book, especially a nonfiction book, that is spectacular. I've talked to friends, well, granted it was fiction, but you know, they were pleased to reach a few hundred copies. And I think last I heard it was like 700 or 800 copies. And that was a huge milestone for them. And then I told them my book currently was at 4,000 copies. And they were like, what? And you know, it's all relative. And like, it's hard to argue with like the book sits on the Amazon top lists next to some of my favorite books ever, like A Book of Lenses, right? It is comparable. It is keeping pace. For my book, when you take out Amazon, I don't know what they take, the industry standard platforms, you know, Google and whatever else is 30%. It's probably around there. Taxman, Uncle Sam comes after me. That's 20-30%. I live in America where healthcare is extremely expensive. So out of that 35, I probably pocket, I don't know, 15K. Also, we have run ads. We run ads very aggressively, my wife and I, during Christmas season, because the book kind of sells itself. It really sells like hotcakes. It reaches almost 100 sales a day with a little bit of boost from ads and my own content marketing efforts. So, you know, however much we spent on ads, I don't know. It could be as much as 5K or something. I don't know. I'm just guessing here. But, you know, at the end of the day, the amount in my pocket from the book is probably like 10K. And we're talking over 2 years. The book came out March of 2021. Is that right? Right? But it's not like the book didn't make 35K yesterday. You know what I mean? It's... If you do the math, it's paid me probably less than minimum wage. So like, it sounds good, but it's not like it's passive revenue. It's a trickle. It is not paying my mortgage. It is not paying for trips to Costco. You know what I mean? Now, that is to say, like, if I had written 10 books, then maybe now we're talking. I might actually be able to like sustain myself on that. But I mean, the one book part-time, granted, you know, I was only working on the weekends because I had a full-time job at the time, but the book took me 2 years to write. So I'm at that point, I need money, right? I got to pay the bills, and there's a million ways to go about it. I could run a Kickstarter for my next game, and I thought about that. I actually have talked about that in the podcast before, a Kickstarter for Pixel Washer, and the reason I wanted to do that is because my friend Ben, otherwise known as You Heartbeast, was going to kickstart his game Wassered, and I'm of this mentality now where like I recognize I don't have a big audience, right? Like I'm grateful that you're listening to this. I know you're here. There are hundreds of you listening to me on Spotify. There's thousands following me on Twitter. But it is I have a tiny audience. Like if you look around at other creators, they have tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. I don't even have 10,000. No matter how you cut it, no matter how you slice it. I maybe have 10,000 followers if you add up YouTube and Twitter and all that, but it's like I would barely hit that mark. Whereas, you know, really successful creators, you know, I mean, go look at Game Maker's Toolkit, you know, that's the kind of audience you need to be able to be like, oh, I can confidently kickstart a game. So the Kickstarter made less sense for Ben over time. And so when he dropped out, I kind of did too, because I think that, because Ben has got a big audience, right? If him and I were to launch games together, I think that we could make each other's Kickstarters take off. But I don't see on my own a path to success, especially when I think about I've attempted two Kickstarters before. Crypt Run, which turned into a Wizard Blizzard, made like 10K. And then we failed to launch the sequel. And we asked for something that was pretty low for two developers and a musician, which was 40K. And I don't think we even hit half that mark. But you know, I mean, I know some of you listening remember this stuff because you were there and you contributed, and I thank you, and I appreciate you. But I have low confidence for kickstarting a game just because it is a whole, like, as good as you need to be at making games, as good as you need to be at making a Steam page, that's how good you need to be at Kickstarter. It takes months. You need to talk to people. You need to get feedback. You need to iterate on it. There's a lot to it. And I'm not completely writing it off, but I don't currently see a path to quick success. Here's the thing, too, is I'm very interested in publishers right now because I believe that Pixel Washer is a highly marketable game, and I think it could really take off if managed by the right publisher. And, you know, if you go and you try to kickstart a game and it fails, good luck finding a publisher after that, right? Because they're going to go look, and they're going to see, like, oh, this Kickstarter couldn't even get 10K. How are we supposed to promote this game? Like, that's not going to happen. I've thought about kickstarting my next book. I have two or three book ideas, if you can believe it, and I want to make them exactly like How to Make a Video Game All by Yourself. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. From what I've learned, I think I would have an easier time distributing my book if it were a different size entirely. Like, the industry standard is a 6x9, kind of like a portrait-sized book, and, like, that makes sense, right? Most of the books that you own are probably that size. The book I'm reading right now, it's a book about bear attacks, like Alaskan bears. I don't know why I'm reading that, but it's a 6x9 book, and that's how most books are. And there are certain places I can't distribute my book because it's a 6x6 inch book. It's a weird custom size. So part of me wants to change the size. The other part of me is like, do not do it. Use the template for my book as a shell. See how I'm bringing it back? Don't change anything. Do it exactly the same way. I would do the exact same page numbers if I'm going to make another book. It would look exactly the same, just different content and brand new drawings and text and all that, right? I've thought about kickstarting another book, and I do think I could be successful with that because I think it would only take, I don't know, I need to do the math, but maybe 10 or 20K. And I think that with my audience and those of you that support me, I think I could hit that. But there's a big sticking point there, which is that the paperback version of the book would be really hard to distribute for several reasons. First of all, just based on my conversations with Ben, who has, again, You Heartbeast, he's got his own book he made called Production Point, which I do highly recommend. Go pick up a copy. He crowdsourced his book, and the shipping was a big headache for him, and maybe not even having worth doing. That's the worst worded sentence I've maybe ever put together. But, like, I think it was especially, like, the shipping, but then especially shipping outside of other countries can get really expensive. And I've seen this. I've actually lost money on signed copies of my book. If you go to valadria.gumroad.com, you can buy a signed copy of my book. I think it's pretty affordable. It's like $25, and the shipping is the extra, though. I lost money on one copy. I think I sent it to Ukraine or somewhere, but I looked up how much shipping would be, and I was like, yeah, it's gonna be like $35. And then when I got the actual address, it was like $50 or $55. And I was like, oh, wow, I'm just gonna eat that. And that's fine on an off by one, right? But that could kill you if it was like, oh, that's $1,000 now that you have, like, you know, if you're losing $20 a book, you could go bankrupt. I don't know. So I'm scared of that. I think that the only real way I could kickstart the book is if the Kickstarter was only giving the backers digital copies, because those are easy for me to fulfill. No matter what I do next for a book, there definitely will be a digital copy. The book sells pretty well on Kindle. It sells, here's a little tip, or just an factoid. The book sells 5 or 10 times better paperback on Amazon. I don't know what other people's numbers look like, but that's what my numbers look like. So I know people want the paperback more than they want the digital copies, but I can't picture a Kickstarter that... Oh, here's another factor too. I could work with other companies. I could try some other different service that gives me more printing options. But Amazon, when you use you go self-publishing through Amazon, KDP gives you no options of, like, getting pre-launch copies. So I wasn't able to get the book in my hands before the book launched, that didn't have, like, a big not for resale banner splattered across the top of it. I could only get these kind of proofs, right? And it wasn't until the book was available for sale on Amazon that I could order copies at all, like author copies for myself. They let you order, like, at cost. They let you order something crazy, like up to 500. They just, like, crate you a bunch of books. But you can't do that until it's for sale. So even if I were to offer physical copies in a Kickstarter, I wouldn't be able to fulfill those orders until after you could just go buy it on Amazon. So that doesn't make any sense. So let me know, though. I mean, if you're listening to this podcast, you are exactly the audience that the Kickstarter would be hoping to attract. So please join the Discord or send me an email, rictor@gmail.com, or just tweet at me at rictor. Let me know if you would back a Kickstarter for my next book that didn't give you a paperback, that was just a digital copy. It would give you a PDF and an EPUB and... I guess that's all I can offer. But, that is the book. And, you know, you would get stuff along the way. You'd get, like, behind-the-scenes stuff, and you'd be able to participate in what the content looks like and all that. The more info you want to give me, let me know. First of all, just yes or no, would you back it if it weren't giving you any paperback books? And how much would you... what kind of rewards would you be looking for, and how much would you participate? That stuff is all really useful to me as well. Other paths to money... The money episode. Coaching is something I'm thinking about doing. This is a really hard one too, because I think that there's this difficulty. The people that I would be coaching a lot of times are students or people who don't have a lot of money. And when you coach, like, say, by the hour, I think, like, this is one of those things where, like, Making Big Indie Games is this tutorial package I launched. And I launched it at $150 with a $50 off coupon, and that was, like, after doing some research, that was about half as much as some of the tutorial packages by people I follow who offer such things. And similarly, a lot of the people I follow who offer those things also offer these kinds of coaching or hourly, you know, they sell off your time for an hour. You know, a lot of times you'll have, like, a Calendly, right? And you can just go, I'm gonna grab that hour, and it's however much money. And the most I saw was $900 for 45 minutes. And I could not believe that. The more average what I see is about $300 per hour. But I think that because of the kind of audience that I have, I would probably go more for like $150. And that would be kind of close to breaking even, honestly. So coaching is hard. I do think the one upside is that a lot of my audience is also people who are engineers, who get paid well and can easily afford $150 an hour if they wanted to get some coaching from me. I have coached before. I know some of you listening to this have been coached by me. I think I'm pretty good at it. I think if nothing else, what you get is you get me as an excitable person with a lot of knowledge. Like, I devour GDC videos. Almost anything that you ask me, I could send you like a dozen GDC videos on the topic. Either I've written an article on the topic, or I'll send you to probably a Chris Zukowski article that's covered the topic. But really what I want is a publisher. If you know any publishers who want to publish Pixel Washer, I'm not expensive. The game, I think, is going to be successful. I think I've got a great pitch deck. The demo on Windows, I think, is really fun to play. I've got my short list of dream publishers to work with. That's what I really want. I want a publisher to come in, fund my game, and we'll make a bunch of money together. So that's my money rant. This was my... UI is a critical game dev skill episode combined with my shell episode. Keep in mind the shell. Don't forget the shell. Do you have a shell? If you don't have a shell, which again, just a reminder, that is a game you've shipped that you can now scoop out its guts and use for your next game, and it gets you ahead. It makes you jump ahead real fast, because all of a sudden, a lot of that crap you don't want to do, like configurable gamepads and keyboards, that's all done. Your menus are done. You're not rewriting a bunch of crap. You're using your shell to catapult yourself and your game to the next level, right? That's a shell. And then that was my money episode. But that's kind of my follow-up to the two-year indie postmortem, is that, like, now that I've run through my runway, where am I at now? And I'm thinking about things like shells. I'm thinking about what to do next about money. And I am doing my best to, lots of different avenues, as I discussed, to go and get money. Definitely a Kickstarter or two is on my mind. And I really want a publisher to come in and talk to me. And I'm reaching out to them. You know, last but not least, if you know of any contracts, or if you are a wealthy investor, get in touch. I am ready for your investment. But that's it for me. Thanks for listening. I know this was a long episode. I hope it was enjoyable. Good luck with your indie game It's time for you to go make the game.